25. The tables had been moved to one end of the dance floor. On each one was a black tablecloth. The curtains were still drawn. A thick salmon-colored light fell through them. Just beneath the orchestra platform, the coffin sat. It was an expensive one, black with silver fittings, the trestles hidden by a mass of flowers. In wreaths and crosses and other shapes of ceremonial mortality, the mass appeared to break in a symbolical wave over the bier and on upon the platform and the piano, the scent of them thickly oppressive. The proprietor of the place moved about among the tables, speaking to the arrivals as they entered and found seats. The Negro waiters in black shirts beneath their starched jackets were already moving in and out with glasses and bottles of ginger ale. They moved with swaggering and decorous repression. Already the scene was vivid, with a hushed, macabre air a little febrile. The archway to the dice room was draped in black. A black pall lay upon the crap table, upon which the overflow of floral shapes was beginning to accumulate. People entered steadily, the men in dark suits of decorous restraint, others in the light, bright shades of spring, increasing the atmosphere of macabre paradox. The women, the younger ones, wore bright colors also, in hats and scarves. The older ones in sober gray and black and navy blue, and glittering with diamonds. Matronly figures resembling housewives on a Sunday afternoon excursion. The room began to hum with shrill, hushed talk. The waiters moved here and there with high, precarious trays, their white jackets and black shirts resembling photograph negatives. The proprietor went from table to table with his bald head, a huge diamond in his black cravat, followed by the bouncer, a thick, muscle-bound, bullet-headed man, who appeared to be on the point of bursting out of his dinner jacket through the rear, like a cocoon. In a private dining room, on a table draped in black, sat a huge bowl of punch floating with ice and sliced fruit. Beside it leaned a fat man in a shapeless greenish suit, from the sleeves of which dirty cuffs fell upon hands rimmed with black nails. The soiled collar was wilted about his neck in limp folds, knotted by a greasy black tie with an imitation ruby stud. His face gleamed with moisture, and he adjured the throng about the bowl in a harsh voice. "Come on, folks, it's on Jane. It don't cost you nothing. Step up and drink. There wasn't never a better boy walked than him." They drank and fell back, replaced by others with extended cups. From time to time, a waiter entered with ice and fruit and dumped them into the bowl. From a suitcase under the table, Jean drew fresh bottles and decanted them into the bowl. Then, proprietorial, adjurant, sweating, he resumed his harsh monologue, mopping his face on his sleeve. "Come on, folks, it's all on Jean. I ain't nothing but a bootlegger, but he never had a better friend than me. Step up and drink, folks. There's more where that come from." From the dance hall came a strain of music. The people entered and found seats. On the platform was the orchestra from a downtown hotel in dinner coats. The proprietor and a second man were conferring with the leader. "Let them play jazz," the second man said. "Never nobody liked dancing no better than Red." "No, no," the proprietor said. "Time Gene gets them all ginned up on free whiskey, they'll start dancing. It'll look bad."
"How about the Blue Danube?" the leader said.
"No, no, don't play no blues, I tell you," the proprietor said. "There's a dead man in that beer."
"That's not blues," the leader said.
"What is it?"
the second man said. "A waltz. Strauss."
"A wop?" the second man said. "Like hell. Red was an American. You may not be, but he was. Don't you know anything American? Play 'I Can't Give You Anything But Love.' He always liked that."
"And get them all to dancing?" the proprietor said. He glanced back at the tables where the women were beginning to talk a little shrilly.
"You better start off with 'Nearer, My God, to Thee,'" he said, "and sober them up some. I told Jean it was risky about that punch,
starting it so soon. My suggestion was to wait until we started back to town. But I might have known somebody'd have to turn it into a carnival. Better start off solemn and keep it up until I give you the sign.
Red wouldn't like it solemn, the second man said, and you know it.
Let him go somewheres else then, the proprietor said. I just done this as an accommodation. I ain't running no funeral parlor.
The orchestra played Nearer My God to Thee. The audience grew quiet. A woman in a red dress came in the door unsteadily.
Whoopee, she said. S'long, Red. He'll be in hell before I could even reach Little Rock.
Shh, voices said.
She fell into a seat. Jean came to the door and stood there until the music stopped.
Come on, folks, he shouted, jerking his arms in a fat, sweeping gesture. Come and get it. It's on, Jean. I don't want a dry throat or eye in this place in 10 minutes.
Those at the rear moved toward the door. The proprietor sprang to his feet and jerked his hand at the orchestra. The cornetist rose and played In That Haven of Rest in solo. But the crowd at the back of the room continued to dwindle through the door where Jean stood waving his arm. Two middle-aged women were weeping quietly beneath flowered hats. They surged and clamored about the diminishing bowl. From the dance hall came the rich blare of the cornet. Two soiled young men worked their way toward the table, shouting, "Gangway! Gangway!" monotonously, carrying suitcases. They opened them and set bottles on the table, while Jean, frankly weeping now, opened them and decanted them into the bowl.
"Come up, folks. I couldn't have loved him no better if he'd have been my own son," he shouted hoarsely, dragging his sleeve across his face.
A waiter edged up to the table with a bowl of ice and fruit and went to put them into the punch bowl.
"What the hell you doing?" Jean said. "Putting that slop in there. Get the hell away from here."
"Ray," they shouted, clashing their cups, drowning all save the pantomime as Jean knocked the bowl of fruit from the waiter's hand and fell again to dumping raw liquor into the bowl, splashing it into and upon the extended hands and cups. The two youths opened bottles furiously. As though swept there upon a brassy blare of music, the proprietor appeared in the door, his face harried, waving his arms.
"Come on, folks," he shouted. "Let's finish the musical program. It's costing us money."
"Hell with it," they shouted.
"Costing who money?"
"Who cares?"
"Costing who money?"
"Who begrudges it? I'll pay it. By God, I'll buy him 2 funerals.
"Folks, folks," the proprietor shouted. "Don't you realize there's a beer in that room?"
"Costing who money?"
"Beer," Jean said.
"Beer," he said in a broken voice.
"Is anybody here trying to insult me by—"
"He begrudges Red the money."
"Who does?"
"Joe does, the cheap son of a bitch."
"Is somebody here trying to insult me? Let's move the funeral in. This is not the only place in town."
"Let's move Joe."
"Put the son of a bitch in a coffin. Let's have 2 funerals.
"Beer? Beer? Is somebody—"
"Put the son of a bitch in a coffin. See how he likes it."
"Put the son of a bitch in a coffin," the woman in red shrieked.
They rushed toward the door, where the proprietor stood waving his hands above his head, his voice shrieking out of the uproar before he turned and fled. In the main room, a male quartet engaged from a vaudeville house was singing. They were singing mother songs in close harmony. They sang "Sonny Boy." The weeping was general among the older women. Waiters were now carrying cups of punch into them, and they sat holding the cups in their fat, ringed hands, crying. The orchestra played again. The woman in red staggered into the room.
"Come on, Joe," she shouted. "Open the game. Get that damn stiff out of here and open the game."
A man tried to hold her. She turned upon him with a burst of filthy language and went on to the shrouded crap table and hurled a wreath to the floor. The proprietor rushed toward her, followed by the bouncer. The proprietor grasped the woman as she lifted another floral piece. The man who had tried to hold her intervened, the woman cursing shrilly and striking at both of them impartially with the wreath. The bouncer caught the man's arm. He whirled and struck at the bouncer. who knocked him halfway across the room. Three more men entered. The fourth rose from the floor, and all four of them rushed at the bouncer. He felled the first and whirled and sprang with unbelievable celerity into the main room. The orchestra was playing. It was immediately drowned in a sudden pandemonium of chairs and screams. The bouncer whirled again and met the rush of the four men. They mingled. A second man flew out and skittered along the floor on his back. The bouncer sprang free. Then he whirled and rushed them, and in a whirling plunge they bore down upon the bier and crashed into it. The orchestra had ceased and were now climbing onto their chairs with their instruments. The floral offerings flew. The coffin teetered. "Catch it!" a voice shouted. They sprang forward, but the coffin crashed heavily to the floor, coming open. The corpse tumbled slowly and sedately out and came to rest with its face in the center of a wreath.
"Play something," the proprietor bawled, waving his arms. "Play, play!"
When they raised the corpse, the wreath came too, attached to him by a hidden end of wire driven into his cheek. He had worn a cap, which, tumbling off, exposed a small blue hole in the center of his forehead. It had been neatly plugged with wax and was painted, but the wax had been jarred out and lost. They couldn't find it, but by unfastening the snap in the peak, they could draw the cap down to his eyes. As the cortege neared the downtown section, more cars joined it. The hearse was followed by six Packard touring cars with the tops back, driven by liveried chauffeurs and filled with flowers. They looked exactly alike and were of the type rented by the hour by the better-class agencies. Next came a nondescript line of taxis, roadsters, sedans, which increased as the procession moved slowly through the restricted district, where faces peered from beneath lowered shades toward the main artery that led back out of town, toward the cemetery. On the avenue, the hearse increased its speed, the procession stretching out at swift intervals. Presently, the private cars and the cabs began to drop out. At each intersection, they would turn this way or that, until at last only the hearse and the six Packards were left, each carrying no occupant save the liveried driver. The street was broad and now infrequent, with a white line down the center that diminished on ahead into the smooth asphalt emptiness. Soon the hearse was making 40 miles an hour, and then 45, and then 50. One of the cabs drew up at Miss Reba's door. She got out, followed by a thin woman in sober, severe clothes and gold nose glasses, and a short, plump woman in a plumed hat, her face hidden by a handkerchief, and a small, bullet-headed boy of 5 or 6. The woman with the handkerchief continued to sob in snuffy gasps as they went up the walk and entered the lattice. Beyond the house door, the dog set up a falsetto roar. When Minnie opened the door, they surged about Miss Reba's feet. She kicked them aside. Again they assailed her with snapping eagerness. Again she flung them back against the wall in muted thuds.
"Come in, come in," she said, her hand to her breast.
Once inside the house, the woman with the handkerchief began to weep aloud.
"Didn't he look sweet?" she wailed. "Didn't he look sweet?"
"Now, now," Miss Reba said, leading the way to her room. "Come in and have some beer. You'll feel better. Minnie?"
They entered the room with the decorated dresser, the safe, the screen, the draped portrait.
"Sit down, sit down," she panted, shoving the chairs forward.
She lowered herself into one and stooped terrifically toward her feet.
"Uncle Bud, honey,"
the weeping woman said, dabbing at her eyes,
"come and unlace Miss Reba's shoes."
The boy knelt and removed Miss Reba's shoes.
"And if you'll just reach me them high slippers under the bed there, honey," Miss Reba said.
The boy fetched the slippers. Minnie entered, followed by the dog. They rushed at Miss Reba and began to worry the shoes she had just removed.
"Scat!"
the boy said, striking at one of them with his hand. The dog's head snapped around, its teeth clicking, its half-hidden eyes bright and malevolent. The boy recoiled.
"You bite me, you thorn bitch," he said.
"Uncle Bud,"
the fat woman said, her round face ridged in fatty folds and streaked with tears, turned upon the boy in shocked surprise, the plumes nodding precariously above it. Uncle Bud's head was quite round, his nose bridged with freckles like splotches of huge summer rain on a sidewalk. The other woman sat primly erect, in gold nose glasses on a gold chain and neat iron-gray hair. She looked like a schoolteacher.
"The very idea," the fat woman said. "How in the world he can learn such words on an Arkansas farm, I don't know."
"They'll learn meanness anywhere," Miss Reba said.
Minnie leaned down a tray bearing three frosted tankards. Uncle Bud watched with round cornflower eyes as they took one each. The fat woman began to cry again.
"It looks so sweet," she wailed.
"We all got to suffer it," Miss Reba said. "Well, may it be a long day," lifting her tankard.
They drank, bowing formally to one another. The fat woman dried her eyes. The two guests wiped their lips with prim decorum. The thin one coughed delicately aside behind her hand.
"Such good beer," she said.
"Ain't it?" the fat one said. "I always say it's the greatest pleasure I have to call on Miss Reba."
They began to talk politely, in decorous, half-completed sentences, with little gasps of agreement. The boy had moved aimlessly to the window, peering beneath the lifted shade.
"How long's he going to be with you, Miss Myrtle?"
Miss Reba said.
"Just till Saturday," the fat woman said. "Then he'll go back home. It makes a right nice little change for him, with me for a week or two, and I enjoy having him. Children are such a comfort to a body,"
the thin one said.
"Yes," Miss Myrtle said. "Is them two nice young fellas still with you, Miss Reba?"
"Yes," Miss Reba said.
"I think I gotta get shut of them, though. I ain't specially tender-hearted, but after all, it ain't no use in helping young folks learn this world's meanness until they have to. I already had to stop the girls running around the house without no clothes on, and they don't like it."
They drank again, decorously, handling the tankards delicately, save Miss Reba, who grasped hers as though it were a weapon, her other hand lost in her breast. She set her tankard down empty.
"I get so dry, seems like," she said. "Won't you ladies have another?"
They murmured ceremoniously.
"Minnie?"
Miss Reba shouted. Minnie came and filled the tankards again.
"Really, I'm right ashamed," Miss Myrtle said. "But Miss Reba has such good beer. And then we've all had a kind of upsetting afternoon."
"I'm just surprised it wasn't upset no more," Miss Reba said, "giving away all that free liquor like Jean done."
"It must have cost a good piece of Jack,"
the thin woman said.
"I believe you," Miss Reba said. "And who got anything out of it? Tell me that. Except the privilege of having this place hell full of folks not spending a cent."
She had set her tankard on the table beside her chair. Suddenly she turned her head sharply and looked at it. Uncle Bud was now behind her chair, leaning against the table.
"You ain't been into my beer, have you, boy?"
she said.
"You, Uncle Bud," Miss Myrtle said. "Ain't you ashamed? I declare it's getting so I don't dare take him nowhere. I never see such a boy for snitching beer in my life. You come out here and play now. Come on."
"Yes'm," Uncle Bud said. He moved in no particular direction. Miss Reba drank and set the tankard back on the table and rose.
"Since we all been kind of tore up," she said, "maybe I can prevail on you ladies to have a little sup of gin."
"No, really," Miss Myrtle said. "Miss Reba's the perfect hostess,"
the thin one said.
"How many times you heard me say that, Miss Myrtle?" "I wouldn't undertake to say, dearie,"
Miss Myrtle said. Miss Reba vanished behind the screen.
Did you ever see it so warm for June, Miss Lorraine? Miss Myrtle said.
I never did, the thin woman said. Miss Myrtle's face began to crinkle again. Setting her tankard down, she began to fumble for her handkerchief.
It just comes over me like this, she said. And them singing that sunny boy and all, he looks so sweet, she wailed.
Now, Miss Lorraine said, drink a little beer, you'll feel better. Miss Myrtle's took again, she said, raising her voice.
I got too tender a heart, Miss Myrtle said.
She snuffled behind the handkerchief, groping for her tankard. She groped for a moment, then it touched her hand. She looked quickly up.
You, Uncle Bud, she said, didn't I tell you to come out from behind there and play? Would you believe it? The other afternoon when we left here, I was so mortified I didn't know what to do. I was ashamed to be seen on a street with a drunk boy like you.
Miss Reba emerged from behind the screen with three glasses of gin.
This to put some heart into us, she said. We're sitting here like three old sick cats.
They bowed formally and drank, patting their lips. Then they began to talk. They were all talking at once, again in half-completed sentences, but without pauses for agreement or affirmation.
It's us girls, Miss Myrtle said. Men just can't seem to take us and leave us for what we are. They make us what we are. Then they expect us to be different. Expect us not to never look at another man while they come and go as they please.
A woman that wants to fool with more than one man at a time is a fool, Miss Reba said. They're all trouble. And why do you want to double your trouble?
And the woman that can't stay true to a good man when she gets him, a free-hearted spender that never give her an hour's uneasiness or a hard word.
Looking at them, her eyes began to fill with a sad, unutterable expression of baffled and patient despair.
Now, Miss Myrtle said. She leaned forward and patted Miss Reba's huge hand.
Miss Lorraine made a faint clucking sound with her tongue.
You'll get yourself started.
He was such a good man, Miss Reba said. We was like two doves. For 11 years we was like two doves.
Now, dearie, Miss Myrtle said.
It's when it comes over me like this, Miss Reba said, seeing that boy laying there under them flowers.
He never had no more than Mr. Benford had, Miss Myrtle said.
Now, drink a little beer.
Miss Reba brushed her sleeve across her eyes. She drank some beer.
He ought to know better than to take a chance with Popeye's girl, Miss Lorraine said.
Men don't never learn better than that, dearie,
Miss Myrtle said.
Where you reckon they went, Miss Reba?
I don't know and I don't care, Miss Reba said. And how soon they catch him and burn him for killing that boy, I don't care neither. I don't care none.
He goes all the way to Pensacola every summer to see his mother, Miss Myrtle said. A man that'll do that can't be all bad.
I don't know how bad you like him then, Miss Reba said. Me trying to run a respectable house that's been running a shooting gallery for 20 years, and him trying to turn it into a peep show.
It's us poor girls, Miss Myrtle said, causes all the trouble and gets all the suffering. I heard 2 years ago he wasn't no good that way,
Miss Lorraine said.
I knew it all the time, Miss Reba said. A young man spending his money like water on girls and not never going to bed with one. It's against nature. All the girls thought it was because he had a little woman out in town somewhere. But I says, mark my words, there's something funny about him. There's a funny business somewhere.
He was a free spender, all right, Miss Lorraine said. The clothes and jewelry that girl bought, it was a shame. Miss Reba said. There was a Chinese robe she paid $100 for, imported it was,
and perfume at $10 an ounce. And next morning when I went up there, they was all watered in the corner, and the perfume and rouge busted all over them like a cyclone. That's what she'd do when she got mad at him, when he'd beat her. After he shut her up and wouldn't let her leave the house, having the front of my house watched like it was a...
She raised the tankard from the table to her lips. Then she halted it, blinking.
"Where's my Uncle Bud?"
Miss Myrtle said. She grasped the boy by the arm and snatched him out from behind Miss Reba's chair and shook him, his round head bobbing on his shoulders with an expression of equable idiocy.
"Ain't you ashamed? Ain't you ashamed? Why can't you stay out of these ladies' beer? I'm a good mind to take that dollar back and make you buy Miss Reba a can of beer. I am, for a fact. Now, you go over there by that window and stay there. You hear?"
"Nonsense," Miss Reba said. "There wasn't much left. You ladies are about ready, too, ain't you? Minnie?"
Miss Lorraine touched her mouth with her handkerchief. Behind her glasses, her eyes rolled aside in a veiled, secret look. She laid the other hand to her flat spinster's breast.
"We forgot about your heart, honey,"
Miss Myrtle said.
"Don't you reckon you better take gin this time?"
"Really, I..." Miss Lorraine said.
"Yes, do," Miss Reba said.
She rose heavily and fetched three more glasses of gin from behind the screen. Minnie entered and refilled the tankards. They drank, patting their lips.
"That's what was going on, was it?"
Miss Lorraine said.
"First I knowed was when Minnie told me there was something funny going on,"
Miss Reba said.
"How he wasn't here hardly at all, gone about every other night, and that when he was here there wasn't no signs at all the next morning when she cleaned up. She'd hear them quarreling, and she said it was her wanting to get out, and he wouldn't let her. With all them clothes he was buying her mind, he didn't want her to leave the house, and she'd get mad and lock the door and wouldn't even let him in.
Maybe he went off and got fixed up with one of these glands, these monkey glands, and it quit on him,"
Miss Myrtle said.
"And one morning he come in with Red and took him up there. They stayed about an hour and left, and Popeye didn't show up again until next morning. Then him and Red come back and stayed up there about an hour. When they left, Minnie come and told me what was going on. So next day I waited for them. I called him in here and I says, 'Look here, you son of a bu—'"
She ceased. For an instant the three of them sat motionless, a little forward. Then slowly their heads turned and they looked at the boy leaning against the table.
"Uncle Bud, honey,"
Miss Myrtle said,
"don't you want to go and play in the yard with Reba and Mr. Benford?"
"Yes'm,"
the boy said. He went toward the door. They watched him until the door closed upon him. Miss Lorraine drew her chair up. They leaned together.
"And that's what they was doing?"
Miss Myrtle said.
"I says, I've been running a house for 20 years, but this is the first time I ever had anything like this going on in it. If you want to turn a stud into your girl," I says, "go somewhere else to do it. I ain't going to have my house turned into no French joint."
"The son of a bitch,"
Miss Lorraine said.
"He'd ought to have had sense enough to got an old ugly man," Miss Myrtle said, "tempting us poor girls like that."
"Men always expects us to resist temptation," Miss Lorraine said. She was sitting upright like a schoolteacher.
"The lousy son of a bitch."
"Except what they offers themselves," Miss Reba said. "Then watch them. Every morning for 4 days that was going on. Then they didn't come back. For a week Popeye didn't show up at all, and that girl wild as a young mare. I thought he was out of town on business maybe.
until Minnie told me he wasn't and that he'd give her $5 a day not to let that girl out of the house nor use the telephone. And me trying to get word to him to come and take her out of my house because I didn't want nothing like that going on in it. Yes, Minnie said the two of them would be naked as two snakes, and Papa hanging over the foot of the bed without even his hat took off, making a kind of whinnying sound.
Maybe he was cheering for them, Miss Lorraine said. The lousy son of a bitch. Feet came up the hall. They could hear Minnie's voice lifted in adjuration. The door opened. She entered, holding Uncle Bud erect by one hand. Limp-kneed, he dangled, his face fixed in an expression of glassy idiocy.
"Miss Reba," Minnie said, "this boy done broke in the icebox and drunk a whole bottle of beer." "You boy," she said, shaking him. "Stand up."
Limply, he dangled, his face rigid in a slobbering grin. Then upon it came an expression of concern, consternation. Minnie swung him sharply away from her as he began to vomit.